Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Red Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybrey, and today we're talking about two books by Anna Fine, The Tulip Touch and The Devil Walks. And because a lot of you probably listen to this podcast as a fairly easygoing distraction, I'm going to put a content warning at the top here that this is a more serious discussion than most of our episodes and does include a discussion of child abuse and child murder. So if you're not in the mood or not feeling up to it, feel free to skip this one. I think it is a good episode and we talk a lot about interesting themes, but just a warning so you can make the choice that's right for you. Okay, and without further ado, enjoy. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Ren.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. It feels like emerging from a horrible, mucky swamp into a slightly dismal wood, but it's nicer than the swamp.
Yeah, yeah. You know, suddenly the leaf mold and lichen just seems friendly. And,
yeah, it's fine.
You know, it's fine. It can deal with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So I think for once we're actually talking about what we said we would in the last episode.
People will be really disappointed.
Yeah. Which is The Tulip Touch by Anne Fine from 1996, and sort of supplementarily, The Devil Walks, also by Anne Fine from 2011. I think as we just remembered the existence of The Tulip Touch at the end of last episode, like, oh, we have to do that.
Oh, yeah, it does blip into my mind every few years.
Yeah, so Anne Fine is a very, very prolific English children's book author who wrote a lot of books that a lot of kids in Britain read, particularly Flower Babies. That one's about a boy who has to look after a little flower baby as a sort of parenting project. It gets chucked into the canal.
I know, it's awful, yeah. Like, you really grow attached to this sack of flour.
And, yeah.
booted right into the canal.
Yeah, yeah. And Mrs. Doubtfire, she wrote as well.
Oh, of course.
Which wasn't actually one of my favourites, I think, because I'd watched the film and the book's very different, really. And always felt a little sort of small and dowdy in English in comparison to the Robin Williams production of, you know.
Yeah, more wacky antics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Anne Fine tends towards these quite kind of small, domestic, but vaguely troublesome or troubling. Like, even with these obviously non-horror books like Flower Babies or Bill's New Frock, there are often these sort of moments of disquiet, or she likes dealing in slightly uncomfortable emotions.
Yeah, yeah. They're pretty down to earth. They're quite sharp, and quite have pointy bits to them.
Yeah, that's a good description. And yeah, a lot of them were favourites of mine when I was young. I loved Flower Babies, and Bill's New Frock made quite an impression on me as well, which is about a boy who wakes up. And is he wearing a frock when he wakes up, or is it just like that's what's in his wardrobe, and he sort of is obliged on some level to wear it, and then is so
and then he looks in the mirror. Yeah, he looks in the mirror and he sees like himself as a girl, and everyone treats him as a girl.
Mm.
And it's it's one of those things that it's not a trans story, but it sort of feels like a trans story in a way.
Definitely, a lot of it's sort of about, I guess, socialization and kind of sexist assumptions that are made in the schooling system. Like, girls should have smart handwriting and boys have messy handwriting and stuff like that.
There's also Crummy Mummy in Me, which that's one I liked. Goggle Eyes.
Oh yeah, I don't know if I ever read that one or not.
That was good. It was about a kid who's like mom like gets a new boyfriend and like she hates him basically, but it kind of comes to her. If not like him, at least accept him eventually by the end. How to Write Really Badly.
Oh, that's a great title.
One of my favourites, which is about the class have an assignment to do a how-to book, and the protagonist is like, I can't do anything. You know, I'm rubbish at everything, and then it's like, well, you know, there's one thing you're good at. It's like writing really badly. So he does this how-to book about. But that was really fun. I really liked that one. So as sort of overview of the kind of books that she usually writes, and they're not usually like The Tulip Touch.
No, The Tulip Touch is her cursed book.
Yeah, it really is. It has a very different atmosphere to the rest of her books. It's very unsettling. It's one of those books that I didn't want to have too close to my bed.
Absolutely. Like, for me, it was alongside Roald Dahl's The Witches as being a book by an author I really loved and generally felt pretty safe with. But this one was different, you know, had a different aura. And I think I literally had it at the far end of my bedroom.
Yeah.
Near the door, so it could be thrown out if need be.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you, I'm curious, like what did you remember of it before you reread it for this?
I remember the games. Some of those titles came back to me, like Stinking Mackerel, for instance. These are strange ritualistic games that they play. I remember being scared of Tulip. I remember the cover I had with the eye and the flame in the eye. Yeah. And I remember, probably unfairly, because he wasn't all that bad, but relating the kind of, I very much had one friend at school. One friend who didn't play football, Stuart, and he was sort of my Tulip. I don't want to over exaggerate that. I don't think he had nearly as troubled or deprived or upsetting a background, and he certainly wasn't cruel in the way Tulip was. But he had a tendency to make up a lot of odd, tall tales and lies, which I kind of knew were lies, but went along with. Odd games, which I think I've mentioned before. Like, I remember playing this game where he sort of half pretended, half really did tie me to a chair of skipping ropes in... We had this little store... shed, I guess, on the playing field. It's like the toy shed, basically. And I remember he did this and I sort of sat there and then put a stick, a small branch across the door as though I was locked in there. And I wasn't really. And kids would sort of come in and sort of, you know, give me a sort of curious look or say, oh, you're right. And I was just like, oh, yeah. And that odd liminal space where it was like, it was kind of a game and kind of not, and it was kind of bullying but kind of not, because on some level I was a willing participant. But yeah, just sort of odd kind of semi-imaginary power play and essay tall tales, like, you know, just making up malarkey, like claiming that he played in these championships of bicycle football and that he was like the countywide champion. And you know, of course I should know about bike football. How could I not? And yeah, so some of Tulip's tall tales and lies, the claims she makes, kind of rang home for me. So yeah, I definitely remember having that association when I read it and associating Tulip with Stuart, and but finding Tulip much scarier, and you know, this idea of how things could escalate. And yeah, how about you? What's your memories of the book?
I mean, pretty vague. I remember the cover. I remember being scared of Tulip. And I remembered her being in a field. I remembered the image of her in a field, which is actually where you first meet Tulip in the book. But I don't know, I had that image for some reason. But yeah, pretty light on details, just the atmosphere mostly. is what I remembered. But it's definitely, yeah, it's very different reading it as an adult.
Like as a child, it reads like a horror story with Tulip as the monster.
Yeah.
As an adult, it's deeply sad.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's still a very distressing book, but in very different ways.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder how much of that I picked up as a kid. Like, I wonder how, I don't know if it just all went over my head, but I wonder if part of the disturbing atmosphere of it is about, like, sort of what it says about our society, you know?
I definitely think it is, but I feel like a lot of that went over my head.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically, it's a pretty, like, unflinching sort of exploration of the kind of situation of a kid who's being abused and has no adults willing or able to protect her. And like, I think the thing is, like, unlike in another kind of children's book, Tulip doesn't get, like, miraculously rescued or transported to a magical realm or something. She just grows up into an increasingly troubled teenager and alienates everyone around her with her behaviour, which is a pretty dark direction for a children's book to take.
Oh, yeah. And I found a newspaper article about the Carnegie winners of that year, and this came out the same year as Junk. Have you ever read that?
Oh, I loved Junk as a kid. I absolutely loved that book. Yeah. I learned so much about it. I learned about heroin. I learned about sex work. It was great.
Yeah. So, yeah, a very popular book. You know, I read it and it made a big impression on me, probably around the same age. Right. But it was definitely a book that a lot of adults and parents and educators weren't very happy about.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. And yeah, it was interesting because I found this article about the Carnegie winners and nominees of that year, the Children's Book Awards. Mm. And it's a very dark selection around, you know, drug addiction and bullying and abuse. And yeah, it's interesting because I think it's easy to think of the 90s as this sort of period of kids' fantasy, right? And I forget that there was this real trend towards the kind of gritty social realism for young adult readers. And yeah, you know, that's not necessarily what you might have expected for Anne Fine at the time. You know, there are hints of that from Flower Babies, but yeah, she'd never written anything this dark before. And that makes you sit with these uncomfortable, troublesome and troubling characters. So, as you say, Tulip is not the perfect victim. She clearly is a victim, and you can really see that easily as an adult. But that doesn't mean she's always likable or always nice or not abusive herself. So what do you do with that? But I read an interview about Anne Fine saying that the book, the writing for the book, was inspired by the murder of Jamie Bulger. In which two other children lured away and murdered this slightly younger child. And she says, obviously, the case itself was very disturbing, but also the British reaction, the reaction in the press and the public, that these kids were basically tried like adults. And there was a lot of talk about, you know, lock them up and throw away the key, and these children were just born evil. And that's really the theme she's engaging with in The Tulip Touch. You know, is anyone born evil? And if someone is a victim of their circumstances, well, what do we do with that?
When I read that it was inspired by that case, that sort of made a lot of sense, you know, putting it in context. It sounds like she was saying in that interview that sort of that case, and there were some other cases of like violence by children on other children, and that it sort of caused a sort of national crisis of kind of, you know, what is happening with our society, sort of thing. And her take is very very much not the it's a few bad apples sort of thing. So she says in this same interview, she says, I absolutely fail to understand what is so outrageous and so unthinkable about choosing to create a society that can order its priorities, its huge resources and energy, so that it can catch people before they fall. I mean, it would make the world safer for everyone. And meanwhile, we wouldn't all have to sit here and watch the boys and their toys. Are we going to send another probe to Mars? Are they going to spend another $90 billion? Who cares what's on Mars?
I really want to say that to Elon Musk.
I know, this is before Elon Musk. Yeah. It's very much, I've been reading and thinking a lot about sort of prison abolition and police abolition and sort of ideas of what an abolitionist society is and how you create a society where prisons and police aren't needed, right? And this is the kind of, I feel like this is very sympathetic to that sort of take.
This is a really angry book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it is an angry indictment of British society. And I feel like Anne Fine really shares in some of Tulip's anger. It's interesting that the interviewer, I think in that same interview, assumes that she would relate to the protagonist. And she says, no, I was more of a Tulip growing up.
Yeah.
I found that really interesting. And the copy of the book I have here is published in this Penguin line, young adult line called The Originals.
All right.
So it's been grouped together. It's interesting. So there's these four different groups: for thinkers, for lovers, for survivors, and for rebels. And it's of classics of young adult literature republished. So, you know, for lovers, you've got, say, I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, Postcards from No Man's Land by Aidan Chambers. For thinkers, you have John Steinbeck's The Red Pony, Dear Nobody by Birdie Doherty. For survivors, you have Zed for Zachariah and Stone Cold by Robert Swindles, which we're going to have to cover at some point.
Yeah.
And then this has been grouped alongside The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton and Steinbeck's The Pearl as For Rebels. And Tulip has been classed as the rebel. It says, rebel, tulip, loner, skills, bizarre games, cause to befriend and destroy.
Wow.
And that very much situates Tulip as the anti-hero of this book, and almost as the protagonist, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, definitely. We will get to the plot in a moment.
it's an interesting book.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating. But she does also comment on the darkness of the book in that interview. She says, I really do try to be more careful in what I write for children. I've written 4 adult novels and they're uniformly bleak black comedies. I don't bother at all about the effect I have on my adult reader. But I've always tried to be protective of children, and I think Tulip Touch does come close to the edge. I would hope never to write a darker book than that for children. But I think that in a way it says, yes, things are this bad, but you yourself can make the decision both to go forward and make something of your life, and also to hold sympathy and responsibility for the ones that fall. That fall. I think that is the message of the book.
Yeah. Although both Tulip and our protagonist, our nominally sympathetic protagonist, kind of fails at the second one. And we'll get to the ending of the book and the last word of the book.
Yeah. Okay. Now, with all that said, I'll describe the plot. So our protagonist is Natalie. I think it's about 9 years old at the beginning of the story. And her family have just moved to run a big new hotel called the Palace. And soon after they arrive, Natalie meets Tulip, who's standing in a field near the hotel, holding a kitten in her arms. It turns out that Tulip goes to Natalie's school, and so they become friends, which Natalie quickly realises is a position that no one else wants as Tulip's friend. And while Tulip is allowed to come and play at the palace, Natalie is forbidden from going round to Tulip's house. And when she disobeys her parents and does go, she finds it's kind of a cold and dismal house with broken furniture and smashed bottles in the garden.
Yeah, and could I just read a little of that section?
Of course.
I think it's very powerful. Thanks. I hated Tulip's house. It wasn't just that the carpets were stained and the furniture battered. It was that Tulip herself seemed different, just a shell, as if she'd slipped away invisibly and left some strange, strained imitation in her place to say to me, "What shall we do now?" or "Want another biscuit?" I pushed the packet of damp crumbs aside. I'd have suggested going into her bedroom, but the glimpse of a stained sheet spread over a chair to dry as she kicked closed the door and warned me that wouldn't be welcome. "Should we go into the yard?" I wanted to get out of the kitchen. Tulip's mother was giving me the creeps with her beg pardon smile and her tireless, tuneless humming, as if in that horrible, smelly, sunless back room she'd completely forgotten a song was supposed to have a melody, let alone a beginning and ending. Hearing that awful, interminable drone was like listening to a robot pretend to be a person. The backyard had clumps of weeds waist high, but there were far too many smashed bottles lying about for us to play most of our creeping games. So in desperation, I said, "Let's go and find your kitten." She looked at me blankly. "Well," I corrected myself, feeling stupid, "cat, by now. We don't have a cat." Sorry, I had to end it a bit abruptly because that wasn't an obvious cut-off point.
No, that's all right. That's a really, very evocative passage. And there's also the sort of the looming figure of Tulip's father as well, who's sort of bearing over the house. Natalie makes her excuses and goes and doesn't go back. Tulip invents games for the two of them to play, as you've mentioned, with names like Rats in a Firestorm and Road of Bones. It's said to have the Tulip Touch by Natalie's father for inventing sort of strange, plausible details in her outlandish lies. We get an example of that, such as Tulip saying,
And then this man went grey and keeled over, and as I was phoning for the ambulance, his fingers kept twitching, and his wedding ring made a tiny little pinging noise against the metal of the drain. And the story is kind of told by an older Natalie, sort of looking back on this time. And at one point she sort of looks at a photo of the two of them back at this time when they were inseparable, and says that there's something desolate behind Tulip's smile. Which is a theme we come back to. Yeah, Natalie's mum points out that Tulip's games had a habit of starting well for two and ending badly for one. And usually Natalie is the one who gets in trouble while Tulip gets away with it. Although when they start to play a game tormenting Natalie's little brother, Julius, her mum puts a stop to it. But yeah, Tulip has a habit of sort of saying strange threats in their games. Like, I'll snatch you bald-headed, or I'll make your eyes look like slits in a grapefruit.
These phrases were my disquieting textures of the week, actually.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you want to do a quick jingle at all.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay.
Texture of the week.
These phrases of Tulip's.
Yeah, I mean, they're really vivid and disturbing.
Mm.
I'll peel you alive like a banana. Smile at me wrong today and I'll crush you. I'll make your eyes look like slits in a grapefruit.
Yeah.
And these are words that Tulip's heard from her father first and then uses when talking to Natalie.
My texture was actually the names of the games themselves. Rats in a firestorm, hogs in a tunnel, fat in the fire, malaria, road of bones, days of dumbness, stinking mackerel, all the grey people, along the flaggy shore, fat and loud, guest stalk, wild nights. And we learn what some of these are, but some of them are just, you have no idea, just evocative words. And, you know, can only imagine what is going on in these games.
Yeah, we hear about the rules for some of these games, like stinking mackerel is a game in which you walk past people in the street and then wrinkle your nose as if you smell something disgusting at every person, leading them to worry that, you know, they're smelling bad.
Yeah.
But a lot of these are left to our imagination.
Yeah.
And as you were kind of already hinting, the games grow more and more cruel and outlandish.
Yeah, we see Tulip's cruel streak. She gives a classmate a gift wrap box of dog shit, and then sort of smiles in satisfaction when she sees him cry. And she sort of, when Natalie injures her leg, she's sort of falling around and laughing as Natalie's being taken to A&E. And sort of people, it's kind of the parents and the teachers sort of try to separate Natalie from Tulip. And the headmistress gives Natalie a stern speech about how bad an influence Tulip is, and that Natalie will come to no good as Tulip's hold your coat merchant. But at the same time, there's this sort of dual aspect of it where the adults sort of feel a kind of hands-off pity for Tulip and kind of are sort of glad in a way that Natalie is sort of playing with her, and is, you know, because it makes them feel a little better, like that Tulip has a friend. But at the same time, they're like, oh, don't get too involved with that, Tulip. But also,
you know, salve our conscience a bit by
being and Natalie feels quite aware of this hypocrisy.
Yeah, by the end of the book, that's Natalie's very much cottoned on to what the adults around her are doing. Yeah, so they, and as they get moved from primary to secondary school, they're sort of separated more in school, but they start, the games sort of escalate, and they start one called after school called Home or Havoc, where instead of going home, they cause mischief, really. Sort of flicking mud pellets at people or putting twigs in the spokes of prams. And Natalie sort of goes along with this and only kind of stops Tulip when Tulip lifts someone's pet rabbit out of its hutch by its ears and won't put it back. And they start.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably, potentially the most triggering moment in the book, right, in which we get the clearest hint of sexual abuse.
Did you get that?
Yeah, in that section I got that quite strongly. In what Tulip says to the rabbit, and you know, this completely passed me by, being lucky in that regards as a kid, but you know, as an adult, this really so I'll read the section, but feel free to skip ahead about 2 minutes if you think you don't want to hear that. So "Please," I said, "give him to me." She grinned unpleasantly. "You don't know he's a he. He might be a she. It doesn't matter. You could just let me have a go at cuddling him. Only if you've guessed right." She upturned the squirming rabbit for no more than a couple of seconds. "She's a she, so she's mine. She's not yours, Tulip. She is now." Tulip was crooning in the rabbit's ear. "Who's a clever bunny? Who's going to be a good girl? Who's Tulip's special one? She's not going to make a fuss, is she? Oh no, she isn't going to do that, because she enjoys it, really, doesn't she? And if she starts struggling, she'll get hurt." She finished up so savagely that I knew I was watching something horrible. Nothing to do with the rabbit she was holding, but darker, much darker and hidden, and coming from deep inside Tulip.
Well, I don't know how I missed that, because when you read it, it's...
it's a heavy piece of writing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really upsetting.
Yeah, it really made me catch my breath, actually, when reading it.
I mean, I did wonder, like, I really don't know how I missed that, but I did wonder sort of if there was some suggestion of hinting towards that sort of earlier in the book where it's kind of describes Tulip sort of being flirty with Natalie's dad, in a way, you know, that kind of suggests a awareness of sexuality sort of beyond her.
I mean, her age, Anne Fine's kind of a deft thing. Writer. And a clever writer, so there's nothing there that would be inappropriate for children to read per se. But yeah, if you're, yeah, I think as an adult reading it, that really kind of pulled me up short, and it's, I can see why it's there, and I think it's powerful and important that it's there, and it you know, there's that it's not really returned to outside of giving you a sense that Tulip has really suffered and is really suffering and has been abused in a way that Natalie's not really aware of. that, you know, Natalie kind of goes to her house and thinks, oh yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of cheap and smelly, and, you know, her dad seems mean, but she doesn't really get it. You know, she doesn't get how bad things are.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're left to condemn Natalie for that, because, you know, her home life's very different to that. But you get the sense that there's a great sense of guilt in this book. It feels like it's being narrated by Natalie at the distance of some years.
Yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, you wonder if some of these realisations have come to her in the intervening time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I mean, it's such a clever book because it is operating on so many levels at once. You know, the sort of, yeah, the young Natalie and the older Natalie and the young reader and the older reader.
Yeah, exactly. And so as a reader, your experience kind of mirrors that of Natalie, I think. Or possibly that of Tulip, you know, depending on your experiences. So it's, because I say in many ways, Tulip is kind of the protagonist. So it, yeah, it's a very clever book.
So yeah, Tulip's games are escalating. Basically, they start a game called Little Visits, where they take it in turns to try and be invited into strangers' houses on various pretexts. And then it starts with basically her final game, which is Wild Nights. Natalie says that Tulip's always been fascinated with fire, and in Wild Night she starts setting fires, setting dustbins on fire and that sort of thing. And it's kind of Natalie's relationship with Tulip's getting more and more ambivalent, and she kind of reflects on it and says that she felt like she needed Tulip, to be sort of rude and wild and rebellious and kind of live the life that Natalie wouldn't dare, even as Tulip is like swearing at her and shouting at her and swinging doors in her face and sort of kind of generally being pretty unbearable. There's a scene where they have an art class together, and they have to paint a self-portrait, the teacher sort of gets Natalie to look at it afterwards, and it says, "Everything about it was dark and furious, and every inch of it seemed to suck you in and swirl you round, making you feel dizzy and anxious. And everywhere you looked, your eyes were drawn back, over and over, to the centre, where out of the blackness, two huge forlorn eyes stared out as usual, half begging, half accusing." All that Natalie can say when the teacher tells her to really look at it is, "Oh, Mrs. Miniver, I'm just so glad I'm not her."
And there's that, yeah, that sense of moment where it's not like a fully understood realisation of Tulip's situation, but yeah, I think that's a moment where Natalie kind of breaks out of just thinking about Tulip in relation to her, and which, you know, which is understandable. Tulip does treat Natalie really badly, so you can understand why she's going to be thinking about that a lot. But that's definitely a moment where she manages to break out of that and kind of see how Tulip's suffering.
Yeah. And then after that, sort of Tulip hears that a sister of someone at their school drowned. And she's talking, she won't stop talking about it to Natalie. She's sort of really excitedly talking about it. And Natalie confronts her about the kitten that she had on the first day they met and accuses her of drowning it. And Tulip eventually admits that she did, but that she had to, because if she didn't, her father would just put the kittens in a crock of water and leave them to slowly suffocate. Whereas she, if she did it, it would happen fast. And Natalie at about the same time Natalie overhears the staff talking about Tulip, and one of them comments on Tulip's mother saying that she always gets the feeling that one day she might start screaming and never stop. So, yeah, that's pretty, pretty dark stuff.
Yeah, there's some very upsetting parts of this book.
Yeah. And so we kind of reach like sort of their last wild night, where the point that after which Natalie decides to cut off ties with Tulip, and on that night Tulip sets fire to a barn, and they've kind of walked through it to check its empty, but sort of Natalie's looking at this blaze and thinking about how easily someone could have been hiding in the just somewhere in a corner of the barn, and somehow that sort of breaks the spell, and she's kind of out from under Tulip's influence. And as she separates herself from Tulip, she starts to feel more like herself again, and sort of feels herself growing out from under this shadow she'd been under. But sort of as she reflects on it, it's kind of in this sort of where she's coming more into herself, she also grows into more contempt for Tulip. And kind of as she does better at school and gets more confident, but the sort of adults around her start to ask why she's not bringing Tulip around anymore, and why Tulip didn't get invited to Christmas when it's it's Tulip's favourite time of the year. And they're sort of trying to make Natalie feel guilty, but if she suggests that they sort of seek Tulip out for themselves, they fall silent. And it's kind of where she realises sort of and resents the role that she's been put into, where everyone feels sorry for Tulip, but they wouldn't want to be involved in Tulip's life themselves.
Yeah, obviously this is the theme of the hypocrisy of the adult world has cropped up quite a lot on our podcast, but yeah, it feels very pointed here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and after this, Tulip has no friends anymore and gets wilder, and the police come to the hotel to talk to Natalie, telling her that Tulip has been repeatedly going to the house of the girl who drowned and asking if Muriel, the drowned girl, would like to come out for a walk. And Natalie sort of plays dumb, but is kind of secretly in awe, like just at the gall of Tulip's new game, even as she knows that it's wrong. And she sort of tries to make the police promise they won't tell Tulip's parents because her father will half murder her. And the police say that they have to, but they'll take it gently because I think we all know about Mr. Pierce's temper. Which is just sort of another... Yeah, we kind of... This is sort of what we get to at the end of the book, where Natalie realises that, like, the adults around her knew a lot more about Tulip's home life and abuse than they let on. But, didn't do anything about it. Talking about Tulip's home. So she says, and you knew that. You've known it years and years. That's why you never let me go round there, even at the start. Even back then I heard you telling Mum it was, I imitated his stern voice, no fit place for a child. Well then, he said rather smugly, I was right. But Tulip was a child, wasn't she? If you were so sure I shouldn't have been there, then Tulip shouldn't have been there either. Natalie, people can't go around snatching children and giving them other homes just because their parents are awful. She shouldn't have been left, I said stubbornly. He tried to take my hand. You really mustn't think that nobody tried.
I know for a fact we weren't the only ones to make a few warning phone calls, and both schools were always well aware of Tudor's background. The Pierces have had social workers around there time and again. So everybody was in it. Everyone knew. So what was the matter? I asked sarcastically. Wasn't it bad enough? He rose to his feet and looked down at me. No, he said evenly, after a moment. It wasn't bad enough. And I'm afraid that life's a bit like that, Natalie. It has to be a whole lot worse than bad to count as unbearable. Until it gets to that point, people are on their own. I was disgusted. Utterly disgusted. Yeah.
And that's sort of the last we properly see of Tulip in the book.
Yeah.
You know, she becomes almost cast out to the margins of the book itself.
Yeah. The last interaction between Tulip and Natalie is where sort of they bump into each other after Natalie's received a sort of academic prize, and sort of Tulip tells her to, like, get out of the way, stupid, and then Natalie turns their old game of stinking mackerel back on her and sort of looks over Tulip's kind of stained and badly mended clothes and wrinkles her nose, and then realises that she's taken it too far. But Tulip says, right, if, you know, you're playing a game with me, I'm going to play a game with you, I'm going to choose what the next game is. And Natalie's on her guard, sort of waiting for Tulip to spring something on her, but Tulip waits until Christmas, when sort of no one will notice her, so outside the palace, and she plays her last game of Wild Knights and sets fire to the hotel. And yeah, all the guests get out safely, but they're all outside watching the hotel burn to the ground. So the family leave to move to a new hotel, and the ending passage, Natalie's voice, it says, "People aren't locked doors. You can get through to them if you want." But no one did. No one reached out a hand to Tulip. Nobody tried to touch her. I hear them whispering and they sicken me. "Bus seats," grumbles Mrs. Bedell. "Locker doors," complain the teachers. "Chicken sheds," says the farmers. "Greenhouses, dustbins," moan the neighbours. And Mum says, "A lovely old hotel." But what about Tulip? I shall feel sorry for Tulip all my life. And guilty too. Guilty.
Oh, it gives me shivers.
Yeah, it really does. And yeah, it's really powerful, and I think really interesting bringing in sort of the adults sort of complaining about, you know, vandalism and property damage kind of at the end, and sort of missing the point of the human being.
Yeah, and you know, the way that last word "guilty" hangs in the air, and
mm-hmm.
you know, what, who is guilty, and what does guilt mean in our society, or British society in the late 90s? Like, because, you know, it's easy to condemn Tulip, and there are times where maybe she should be condemned. But she's already suffering and going to have to suffer a lot more than most of the adults in this book. And, you know, she has already been made to live with the consequences of her behaviour. And often, you know, we're given to believe far beyond what she deserves at the hands of her father. Whereas there's no, obviously there's no real comeuppance for all of the deliberately cast aside at the neglect and the lack of caring and the hypocrisy that Natalie's family are able to move to another hotel and change their situation and start again quite happily.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think Anne finds sort of saying, well, what price does this comfort come at? And does maintaining this comfort mean a lot of deliberately looking the other way and maybe pushing people off the raft or the lifeboat? You know, it's a very uncomfortable thing to sit with, especially as we've been with Natalie as the narrator through the whole book, and she's sort of confiding in us as the reader on some level. And so she kind of gets our sympathies, and we kind of maybe find her relatable. Or I think a lot of readers, I definitely related more to Natalie than to Tulip as a kid. And I think that was partly due to my comfort and due to having a nice home life. And yeah, I think that kind of bond and maybe our own sense of comfort as a reader is really shaken at the end of that book.
Yeah. No, it is like, yeah, the ringing last word of guilty. It's like, what are you guilty of? You know, what? How are you guilty? How are you complicit? And
yeah, and I think that's why it makes sense to me that you know, been thinking about prison abolition, you know, alongside rereading this book. Right, because on some level, it never does it overtly, but you could see this as a kind of pro-prison abolitionist
book.
Because ultimately, I think what it's suggesting is that system of punishment and that system of punishment that obviously was used to resolve in heavy, you know, kind of quotation marks, the James Bulger case, the Jamie Bulger case, you know, did it really, what did it help? What did it solve?
You know, and that's just like, it's such a stark example of, you know, of, yeah, of the whole issue. And, you know, the fact that, you know, it was so horrific, but then it had people calling for the death sentence for 10-year-olds, you know?
Yeah, and something's gone really wrong. If that's happening, you know, that's...
Yeah.
A society is in a very troubling place.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, I read an article about, like, The James Bulger case is pretty, there's not a lot of cases like that at all, but there have been other, you know, children who have murdered other children. And I think that there was a case somewhere in Scandinavia, it might have been Denmark or something, where there was comparable, at least, in what happened.
Yeah.
And the children in that case were, like, their names were never made public for a start, like, they were never identified, and they were given some, well, they were given some sort of intensive treatment, sort of, rather than a punitive solution to that.
Because you can't just treat children as adults when it suits the adult society.
Yeah.
You know, to say, okay, well, this child is no longer a child, really, because they transgressed or they're of a certain type, or, you know, that child doesn't magically become an adult and with an adult brain, even if they've done things which are horrible. You know, genuinely horrible. And even if they've done things which we see no child should do or have the idea to do.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, their brain development is still going to be that of a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, you can't, however uncomfortable that is, you can't magic it away. And it's not right or just to do so. And, yeah, you know, I think that's, yeah, Tulip does some really awful things. Mm. You know, she does. You know, your sympathies are tested, but she doesn't magically become anything other than a child who's being horribly abused.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, you know, real justice, needn't be about whether you like someone, you know. You don't have to like Tulip.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no. Yeah.
You know, that's not the point.
Yeah, you don't have to think she's a lovely person to think that she shouldn't be punished for the rest of her life without remission.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting that these themes do come into play in a different way, and probably not as interesting as progressive a way in The Devil Walks.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think you did that on purpose, choosing this book.
I absolutely didn't. I looked through other Anne Fine books, and it seemed like one of the most obvious horror picks.
Yeah.
Because it is a gothic horror.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's certainly interesting that it sort of ends up kind of touching on the same themes, but sort of not going there really at all.
So the character in The Devil Walks who was an evil child, grows up to be an evil man, really does seem like he's a bad seed.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so The Devil Walks, it's a much more straightforward kind of book. It's genuinely creepy and a good gothic horror story, but it does sort of seem like it's kind of actively avoiding engaging with the question that's at the heart of the Tulip Touch.
Like, it's very beholden to the restrictions of that genre. And I'm sure there are lots of, you know, really progressive and interesting, you know, gothic novels, right? And obviously, so like, Frankenstein has its really progressive, interesting elements for the time, for instance. It's not like the gothic novel is inherently not given to philosophically questioning things.
Yeah.
But, it very much... Yeah, it's a bit of a potboiler. Albeit a really enjoyable one.
I'll just read. This is a kind of from a Guardian review of the book. Just a synopsis from when it was released in 2011, which, as a warning, does have some not good language about mental illness in this review. But we can talk about that. But it says Daniel Cunningham's childhood has been stolen by his mother. Although he isn't ill, she has raised, lowered might be a better word, him as a bedridden invalid, denied all society other than her own. Pallid, friendless, deprived of experience, he is like a character in a Paul Auster novel, almost without identity. Indeed, his name isn't really Cunningham. He is a blank page upon which anything might be written. Then in early adolescence, he is rescued suddenly and unwillingly by the life-affirming Dr. Marlowe and embraced by his lively family. Apparently shocked into insanity by this benign kidnapping of her son, Liliana Cunningham hangs herself in the local asylum. There is little for Daniel to inherit other than a very large, exquisitely made doll's house, a fastidious scale model of the great house in which Liliana grew up. This doll's house is the engine of the story. It is also its driving metaphor, for this plaything has a hidden and evil inhabitant.
By publishing a drawing of the model, Marlowe discovers that its original is Highgate's in Sussex and that Daniel has a surviving relative, Uncle Jack, who still lives there. With the best of intentions, the doctor dispatches Daniel to the Downs to be reunited with his uncle. Unfortunately, Captain Jack Seven is a schizoid psychopath and a serial murderer, and his nephew will be his next victim once he has surrendered the thing that the captain most desires.
This reviewer is just sort of deciding to diagnose the Captain Jack character based on his behavior in the text. We don't actually get anything as blunt as that in the novel.
And I don't think it's a deeply psychological novel.
Sorry?
I don't think it's a deeply psychological novel.
No.
Not really.
No.
Like, I don't think... It's really interesting, right? Because one thing our protagonist does enjoy about his childhood, which is obviously really deprived, but he talked about reading and how much he loves adventure stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is totally like an Edwardian adventure story. Like, if it reminded me of anything, it was Treasure Island.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I really liked Treasure Island as a kid. I would have enjoyed this too as a kid. And, yeah, the captain is like Long John Silver, basically. He's utterly ruthless. He's got a bit of charm about him. He's a kind of mercurial figure who mm-hmm. is quite exciting. But, yeah, he's really a cackling villain. But... Yeah, I think we are meant to enjoy him as that, enjoy him as a pantomime villain.
Yeah.
This story is set in a kind of unspecified, vaguely Edwardian past.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
you can imagine him played by Tim Curry, can't you?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah, this is a genre book, it's very much a kind of love letter, I think, to Treasure Island and to those kind of children's adventure classics. I really enjoyed it. You know, it's not going to stay with me whatsoever in the way that The Tulip Touch did.
Yeah.
But it's an enjoyable romp with some nasty bits in it.
it's... It's a very good, gothic horror for kids.
Yeah, some similarities with Rebecca too, I'd say.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can see that. it does feel a tad unfair to compare it to Tulip Touch because they're not going for the same thing.
Although, and this is a bit of a spoiler, though not really, because you kind of know where the Devil Walks is heading. what is really interesting is that they both end on a fire, and the fire of the central kind of house or manor or hotel, in the case of the Tulip Touch, being burnt to the ground.
Yeah.
Right? And what's really interesting is that in the Tulip Touch, this is kind of a howl of pain and anger from Tulip that doesn't really hit the mark, right? It doesn't really provide any catharsis, not for Tulip or anyone else. Tulip's just destroyed the only place she's ever loved, as the narrator points out. And the family, who on some level she wants to hurt because she feels abandoned and let down, which on some level is fair. You know, she was allowed there every Christmas and it was probably the highlight of her life. And she no longer gets to go. And you know, her once best friend is looking at her with abject disgust.
Mm-hmm.
And so she burns down the hotel and they move and take on another hotel.
Yeah, and a nicer, more up-to-date one.
yeah. And they're fine. The mother grumbles a bit, but actually father and brother are like, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
So there is no catharsis here. Like, it's, you know, I say it's a howl of you know, empty rage, really, that doesn't mm-hmm. achieve anything, which is why it's really sad, you know, that yeah, the arson, you know, it burns bright in this moment, and then, you know, it's nothing. whereas in The Devil Walks, the fire is a cleansing moment. The fire is cathartic.
Mm.
Burning down the mansion is this satisfying cathartic end to the novel.
Yeah, yeah.
And our protagonist will quite justly move on to a happy life because he's a thoroughly decent sort.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his antagonist, you know, I guess kind of the tulip grown up of the novel, is a thoroughly nasty sort, and his dead body is engulfed in the flames, and, well, that's the end of it.
Yeah.
Great job.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's fine. I wouldn't take The Devil Walks as a sort of sociological textbook, you know, like...
Yeah, yeah. It's... Yeah, no, it's not. It's just sort of funny how it kind of accidentally kind of provides a complete counterpoint.
Yeah. So I'm kind of glad we sort of accidentally paired them, because it... But I'd recommend them both. I mean, basically, The Devil Walks, if you're in the mood for, you know, a really sharply written, very genre beholden piece of kind of gothic adventure lit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah, maybe some problematic elements, but I don't think anything that's going to really upset people, to be honest. Like,
yeah.
you know.
It's schlocky.
Yeah, it's schlocky, but good schlock. Yeah. The Tulip Touch, if you want something which will stay with you, but is genuinely a hard read, and sometimes a very upsetting read. Yeah. I think, you know, a really brilliant and impressive piece of work. But, you know, be warned, it is a hard read. Even, you know, I'd put it alongside many adult novels as a hard read.
Mm-hmm.
Not of difficulty reading, but in terms of how difficult the issues raised are, and the lack of
what it asks you as a reader to
think about. It asks you some tough things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any final thoughts?
I don't know. I did want to give a nice little shout out to a screaming peacock in The Tulip Touch. Gotta love a screaming peacock for
setting a
tone of unease.
So I thought that was like a Twitter username.
Oh, shout out to Screaming Peacock. Would be a good Twitter username. No, or just a Twitter bot that just screams. Yeah.
Do we still have, like, people on Twitter and stuff? I haven't, you know, since I abandoned all social media at the start of the first lockdown, I've been quite strict with myself. So, do we still have followers and stuff?
We still have some followers, but I haven't had any particular interactions recently, but I think they're still there. So, yeah.
You know, give us a review. You know, we're needy people.
Thank you for people who are listening to our extremely sporadic output. We appreciate it.
Thank you for those who bear with us. You know, I hope you have fun.
we do appreciate suggestions as well. We were going to do Moondale, and we will do it at some point. It just as soon as we decided to do it, it became unavailable on YouTube.
Yeah, I think we're both a bit cash strapped as well. So.
Yeah, we're like $12.99 for the DVD. I don't know about that. So
yeah,
we will come back to it. Yeah. But I got the Devil Walks for $1.99 including postage, Adam. Yeah.
Oh, that's so great.
So that was pretty good. Yeah. But yeah, recommendations are appreciated. And you can contact us on our Twitter, which is at Still Scared Pod. I say us, it's just me because Adam left Twitter. Probably a good idea for
I think it made the last year and a half more bearable, to be honest. Yeah.
it's good. I think that's it's pretty very sensible.
I think so, you know, I'm not completely averse to self-care and
you can also email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Theme music by Maki Yamazaki, intro music and outro music by Joe Kelly, both very talented musicians, and put links to their stuff in the show notes. And our artwork by the very talented artist Letty Wilson, who is great, and you should commission to do like creepy artwork, like if you know you want like a creepy character or something. Like, I can't recommend a better artist than Letty for drawing you a monster or something. I think that's everything. Do you have a sign-off for us, Adam?
Okay, so I was thinking of using some of Tulip's frets as a sign-off, but I kind of feel like, I don't know, they're quite nasty, to be honest. I don't want to just outright fret on our listeners.
Yeah.
I know what I'll say, because if you do read the Tulip Dodge, don't commit any arson. So no going and setting fires, creepy kids.
Don't commit arson, creepy kids. Just, you know, maybe just like have a candle and like dip your fingers in the wax. That's quite satisfying.
Yeah, it is. Be chill.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.